8 decades. Sometimes I feel like it. I just kind of wanted to get up and look at you guys. I love you guys so much. And I mean, this is not a farewell or anything. Sounded like it a little while ago. But I'm getting ready to go to China on early Tuesday morning. And we'll be gone for 30 days. Wilson and I will be going there for, we've been going quite a while now together. And we've been going to China since 1992. And we got a lot of friends over there, a lot of brothers and sisters in Christ there. And it's a great joy for me to do this work. I can't express how excited I get to go to do this work. I know you've listened and looked into the news, and many of you have come up to me and almost think I'm crazy to go. But I mean, I love going, and I want to go. And I see so many people over there who desperately need the gospel, desperately need teaching. It's really exciting to think that on Tuesday we're flying straight over the North Pole. We go into Shanghai from Chicago, and it'll be a 14-hour flight from Chicago to Shanghai, and then we immediately get on a speed train, go 6 hours north to Chongqing, which is on the Siberian coast, Siberian border. It's be like going to Canada from here, and it's already snowing, very, very cold up there already. And we already have Bible classes lined up. There's people sitting there waiting on us. I don't sleep on an airplane, so I already know it's going to be at least 44 hours without sleep. And then I got to teach class. So your prayers are please for me to stay awake, that I can teach the class. I wish I could sleep on an airplane, but in all my years flying, I have never been asleep on an airplane. I can't go to sleep on a plane. I don't know why, but... But I ask for your prayers for Wilson and me, that God will accomplish great good there, and so that souls can be taught, others can be converted. We're going to be hitting several new cities where we're going to be teaching non-Christians, and some classes have already been set up for us, so we are really super pumped about that, that there's other Christians there now. Instead of us trying to generate Bible studies, they're now getting them for us, and so we can hit the ground running. And already have a number of people that we can teach right away. And I'm so excited, especially up in Chongqing and Tianjin are the first two cities we'll be going to. We'll be hitting 6 cities, but those first two have got lots of prospects in them. And then we'll be going to a city we've not been to before, because there was a man we converted several years ago that have now moved to another town, and he's got family and friends that he wants us to teach. So we're going down to be with him and to teach some of his family and friends. And so there's lots of good work to do. And so we're going to be very busy every day. And so we covet your prayers. I know you hear a lot about what's going on down in Hong Kong and the problems that are going on in China right now. We're very well aware of that. And we're not going to get anywhere near that area. We're avoiding Hong Kong like the plague. We used to even go to Haikou, which is just off of the Hong Kong area. It's a little island off the Hong Kong side, and we're not going there this time because it's too close to a lot of the disturbances going on in there. And so especially if you stay out of the south, you're probably going to be just fine. There's been almost nothing going on up north, and so we'll be staying in the northern regions for most of the trip. We will go to Nanning, where there are some American couples that are there from that are working there, doing evangelism, but also going to school to kind of cover for themselves. I hope they're not tuning this in, but that you can. So we go to encourage them as well, and they have lots of Bible studies for us when we get there, because they've been doing lots of studies already. So they've got a lot of prospects, and so there's lots of work to do, and so it's really exciting to go and do this kind of stuff, and so we just covet your prayers. I know. I'm going to do a little lesson here on China. I'm going to do a lesson that a number of you have already seen before on the Chinese characters, but that's going to be near the end. It's been 5 years since I've done them, and I got to thinking about a lot of these guys over here who probably haven't even seen it, or if they did, they wouldn't remember it from 5 years ago. I know some of you wouldn't remember it from 2 years ago. Looking at the, Bob, you. And so when I think about the work that's going on, the Chinese characters and some of the studies that I'll give you tonight, it's evidences, and it's kind of stuff you need to see and stand back and go, wow, God is amazing. That's the way I did. I've done the presentation of the Chinese characters in China probably 200 times. And each time it's so unique because of the audience that's listening, because almost every time they're sitting there listening going, That's just coincidence. That's amazing. That's how the sequence goes almost every time we do this presentation. And so I'll present that to you in just a few minutes. But I want to give you kind of a heads up on just looking at the world. I want you just to look at the world. Look at it. This is something that Paul, the Apostle Paul, couldn't have even begun to dream was real. He couldn't have ever even known about North and South America and all of that. I doubt he'd ever heard of anything over there. I mean, if people even like Columbus in 1492 didn't even know it was really there, then you can imagine people from back in the first century days and just be astounded at how fast this world is and how many people populate this world. Therefore, how many souls are in this world and how God has sought for us to go into all the world, to teach all nations, to baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and then to teach them to observe all things. And that becomes the overwhelming task for those of us who go overseas as well as those who preach here, not just to baptize people, but to lead them to a higher calling, to a purpose in their life. That they can see that there's a reason for getting up in the morning and that there's a reason for even being persecuted for righteousness' sake, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And so when I think of passages like in Mark chapter 16, he tells them, these 12 guys, these band of ambassadors for Christ, to go into all the world and to preach the gospel to every creature. That's a calling that we all have. And I want you to see that wasn't just to the apostles. According to 2 Timothy 2 and in verse 2, the Bible teaches us that the things that Paul said that you have heard, Timothy, I'm going to teach you to teach others to teach others. So in other words, the Great Commission is an ongoing process. It wasn't given just to a band of men 2,000 years ago. It was given to all generations of men to continue to teach all things that I have commanded you. And so we all have a responsibility, whether it's here or abroad. You don't have to go, as the song says, you don't have to go to the far side of the world in order to preach the gospel. You can preach the gospel to your neighbors and friends right beside you in your schools and your workplace. And like Andy pointed out this morning, we all have a purpose in this world, and that is to be lights in this world. And so whether it's you staying here or me going there or Andy going to India or places like that, this is all the work that we all do together. And I couldn't go without you, and so I couldn't do this work unless you were supporting me and helping me and encouraging me and taking care of my family while I'm gone. I couldn't do this work, nor would I do this work if it weren't for you. And so we're all part of this. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of thee. And so we're all part of this body of Christ, and we're all trying to work together. And your prayers are just as powerful in approaching God than my words would be in China. God can open doors where I can't, and He can open doors through your prayers that I might not ever even think about. And so we're all working together as co-workers and laborers in the kingdom. When I think about the idea of the Chinese language, I'm going to be able to shorten this quite a bit from what I do it in China. It takes about two and a half hours in China. You okay? Because we have to read the text in the Chinese to people who've never read the Bible, ever. And so it becomes very difficult. We read basically 11 chapters of Genesis to do this study. You guys don't need that. You guys are way ahead of the game when it comes to understanding Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve. If I have to sit and explain that to some of you, then you need to go back upstairs and get to your Bible teacher. So we're going to be able to do this very quickly, I hope, when we look at this idea of just the first 11 chapters. And when I say Genesis 1 through 11, can you tell me the stories? Like Genesis 1 and 2, got the creation. Genesis 3, we got the fall. We got Adam and Eve, and they're committing. Genesis 4, you got Cain and Abel, raising Cain. He had problems. They weren't able to do that. You had chapter 4, then you had chapter 5. Anybody know what chapter 5 is? With they've got all the genealogies and things that are there, as well as chapter 10. Then you get chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9. Yeah, you got the flood story. And then 10, you have again those genealogies, and they'll come up again. But primarily, I want to look at just for a second Genesis 11. Tower of, not the two towers of the Lord of the Rings, but you got the Tower of Babel, okay? And so you know those, you got all those stories, okay? You know those stories. I bring them up so to kind of refresh your memory. I don't have to go back and read all of those stories, but I'm going to show you how that works in the Chinese language. When we get to this, again, you saw the map. Now look at the numbers. The numbers just they astound you. When you think of 7 billion plus people, almost 8 billion people on planet Earth, it's exploding now. And among those, the 10 largest nations on the Earth are China and India and the United States. And you just put those three countries together and you've got almost 3 billion people there. You do have 3 billion people. So almost half of the world's population, over 40-45% of the world's population, is just in those three nations. And so that just becomes overwhelming when you think about the works that are gone in some of these nations like China and India and places like that. The work that's there. And by the year 2030, India will be the largest nation in the world. In just a few one more decade. When we think about what the job is ahead of us, where we need to go, Paul wanted to go to the major cities. Paul said, I long to go to Rome. I long, to Ephesus, to Corinth, to Athens. He wanted to go to the major metropolises because it was there that you could maybe convert the people, and there'd be a center of where commerce comes and goes, and then you can convert people, and they can go, and they can convert people in their hometowns, and you can spread the gospel much quicker that way. And when I think about what we're doing in China, we're going to the major metropolises. You realize there's 30 cities in China that are over 5 million people. I mean, we would think Chicago is the third largest city in the United States. It would be the 37th city in China. That's just astounding to think about that. New York would be the 8th largest city in China. And so it's just amazing to think of how many places there are. We're going to be going to Guangzhou on this trip. In Guangzhou, Shanghai is 32 million. Beijing is 22 million. Guangzhou is 21 million. And so those are just major cities. It almost just staggers the mind to think how many people are there, how many souls are going to be accountable before God on the day of judgment. And we want to try to talk about that. To do that, how we approach things, to those of you who haven't been in one of these studies with me on this before, how we approach people in China who've never heard the gospel. We always use this. That's why I say I've done it hundreds of times. One of the things you show them is, would you like just to sit and give me a little bit of your time to show you that the Chinese have always believed in one God? And they go, no, we haven't. And you said, yeah, you have. Can you give me a little opportunity to show you why? Because you know your language, and so can I work with you with your language to show you this? And so that's what we do, and then we look at the Chinese language, and we say things like, it's the world's oldest, and they already know this. They've been schooled in this. I'll ask them, what's the oldest language in the world? And they said, Mandarin. I said, well, that's right. It's over 4,500 years old, and it's documented. It's the oldest language in the world. What I mean by that is it's the continuous language. In other words, the language that they would have known thousands of years ago, or the language they're still working. They're doing a lot of upgrading of some of their language now, but for the most part, you can still read the language that you could pull up manuscripts from 3,000-4,000 years ago and still read it in the Mandarin today. That's how old the language is. It's the longest continuous language in the history of writing. And so that helps you a lot, because then you can take the words that they would have put pen to get penned 4,500 years ago, and they're still being used today. And what's interesting is when you look at them from the pictograph, this is how they write their language. They draw it in pictures. It's interesting how they put it together. So this language being written over 4,500 years ago, anybody happen to know how long it has probably been since the Tower of Babel when languages began? From the world's languages, there had been one language up until that time, and then all of a sudden there was a multitude of languages. And the Chinese language would have been one of those that God created that calls men to go from the Garden of Eden, or from the Tower of Babel, to go east. The inventors of the written language drew pictures that you can see there. You can see the words, the simple pictures were combined. They would take a picture, another picture, another picture, and they put it together, and they would create a sound off of those pictures. And so that's how the first languages of the world were put together. The Japanese language, kanji, is built off of that same concept, obviously. And so the kanji, the Japanese, was built off of, in fact, all of the Oriental languages were built off the Chinese language. And so when you look at that idea and take those simple pictures, and you can look at this and you can say, for example, there is a mouth. Does that look like a mouth? It might look like, you know, Guzzle's mouth, but if that is that a mouth, then here are what? Here's two legs. And then so you take the two legs and you put them together and you've got an older brother, obviously, right? But that's how they did it. That's going to make sense here in just a minute, so stay with me. So when you have a mouth and a man, you put those two pictures together. You can see how those two pictures are there. There's the mouth and there's the legs. And so that means that's the word shun. That's the word for older brother. And so, by the way, that's the limit of my Chinese. So the mouth man or the spokesperson for the family was usually the oldest son or brother in the family. That's why, as they called him, kind of their prophet, the mouth man, the spokesman. And so that's how they're putting their language together. And so it was the most well-known in history, the common everyday things they would use and pick a picture here and a picture here and put it together, and then they come up with a word. That's how they built things back years ago. Looking at this idea, and we have to get into conversations with them about Buddhism because Buddha is huge in China. There's Buddha temples all over the place. And so people are familiar with it, even though they might not practice Buddhism, they will sit and say, well, Buddhism is the oldest language, or it's the oldest religion. It's our oldest religion. It's been here since we can, you know, since China, basically. And we say, no, that's not true. It's not even close to being true. They haven't learned their history very well in that regard. So when you go back to 2500 BC, that's when the Chinese wrote their 4,500 years ago. It's when the Chinese wrote their language. And you go, that's right, right? And they go, yeah, that's right. Well, let's say then you go to 1400 BC, and that's when the first five books of the Bible. In other words, the Chinese language predated Moses writing Genesis by how many years? 2500 minus 1400 is even what, Gabe? Yeah, that's right. 1100. Okay, so it's over 1,000 years that they go. That's what schooling is getting us today. That's over 1,000 years between when the Chinese wrote these words that I'm going to show you and when Moses wrote this book. So in other words, when Moses wrote this book, the Chinese had already come up with these concepts. These words that I'm going to show you, they were already in their existence for over 1,000 years before Moses ever wrote Genesis 1. That's very important to understanding this whole process. Buddhism was invented in Buddha, or Buddha, Gautama Buddha, he was the Buddha, or the enlightened one, in 600 BC in India. And it didn't come to China until 50 BC. So over 550 years later, after Buddhism was created in India, it took over 500 more years before it ever even came to China. And so from that, you can kind of see the Chinese have their language already written out. There's the word Shangdi. There's the word for God. And so they had that word. And the word, by the way, the word Shangdi, D-E, the D-I, that means one. They believed in God being one God. They believed in Genesis 1 and in verse 1 that there wasn't but one God. And so this Shangdi that you can see kind of recorded there during the first three dynasties, and the Chinese, by the way, they know their George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and so they know, like we know some of our presidents, they know their dynasties, and they can sit there and rattle off the Xi dynasty and the Shang dynasty and the Chao dynasty, and they can do those very quickly because that's how they're schooled. Their culture and their history is very important to them. And so we can talk about those and say, all those dynasties, look it up. They all believed in Shangdi, one God, not many gods like you would have in the Buddhism and so forth. And so from that, then you have the worship of Buddha came to China about 50 BC. And so this God comes along, and you can kind of see it'd be around 50 BC, which is 600 BC, so it'd be right in here somewhere, is where when Buddhism came there. That's important when you try to explain things to the Chinese. They need to see that history, and they can go check it up. They can look it up on the internet now. Used to couldn't do that, but now we can get them and say, look it up on the internet. When did Buddhism actually come to China? And that comes in handy when you get to discussing the religion of the country here in a little bit. But then we talk about the death of Jesus Christ, and then even to today, and what God is doing, how He's going to do this. Many in China today believe when you say, where do you think the Bible came from? They're going to say, well, that's a Western book. They're going to say it's an American book, or it's from Europe or something like that. They're going to think it's an English book. And of course, we know that's not true. It was not written from an English viewpoint or from a Western culture viewpoint at all. They believe it was myth written by a Western man. They think it is a Western or English book. But of course, we know that's not the case. When we look at the Bible, it's not a Western book. It was not written in English. It was written in Hebrew and then later in Aramaic and Greek. And so it was not at all a Western book. And that, by the way, that surprises a lot of Chinese when you tell them that. They've always thought it was kind of an English book. They've been told that anyway. Its first writers were from Egypt, Moses coming out of Egypt, being the son of a Pharaoh there. And then the modern Iraq is where the Middle East is from. The first five books were written by Moses, son of the king of Egypt. And these five books focus on the beginning of the nation of Israel. But what's interesting is the first 11 chapters. The first 11 chapters already are actually, emphasize, the first five books of the Bible were actually, if you think about what Paul said in Athens in Acts 17, from one blood came all nations of the earth. And we try to make them understand as we read that verse to them that from one blood. And the first 11 chapters of Genesis are not about the Jews. It's not about any of that. It's all about all of us and how all nations are together in one. How we are of one blood. You can look at Chinese blood and draw blood from my veins and they'll look exactly the same. It might be a different type blood, A positive or what, O positive. But it's all blood. It's all coming from the same. It all has original source in Adam and Eve. And so all nations have come from one blood. Then we will now examine then some of the stories then. So these Chinese characters which demonstrate this particular story. And the idea is that we will prove that the ancestors of the modern Chinese knew the same stories that we know from the book of Genesis. This is what's so fascinating to them. This is where they start with, oh, that's just coincidence. Then you give them a second one and a third one. And by the fourth or fifth, all of a sudden it's no longer coincidence anymore. All of a sudden it's starting to be a pattern here. By the way, If you really wanted to get into a study of this, I've got a number of these books called The Discovery of Genesis. This is where I found all of these. I don't know the Chinese language, so somebody had to come up with this. And they started studying the Chinese language, looking at the Bible stories, particularly the first 11 chapters, and were just astounded by hundreds and hundreds of words in the Chinese language that are stories right out of Genesis 1 through 11. It's pretty impressive. So you start with, in other words, how the nations, we start with the Tower of Babel. And I'm not going to read that section to you. You already know the story, how they started building the tower, and then God comes down and confuses their language. In fact, He then says, He comes down, let us go down and confuse their language. So I'm having them read this, and then we get to this point. We emphasize it confuses their language. They might not understand one another's speech. And then He says, the Lord scattered them abroad. And so now you know the picture of how God then, because they get up in the morning and they can't understand what this guy's saying or what this guy's saying, but they have a group of people over here they do understand. In this case, we'd say the Chinese have their language. And so now they're going to go east. Others are going to go north, south, and west, and so forth. And so the nations were scattered at the Tower of Babel. And during that time, which took place, by the way, about 5,000 years ago. You can start doing the math now. If the oldest language in the world is over 4,500 years old, then you can begin to see where the Chinese likely got their stories to show this. The world's oldest language goes back about to that time, and then the languages began to divide, and then the people were scattered. And then notice that as you look at this story, where the Tower of Babel is, today it's in modern Iraq. But now notice if the Bible is true, how all the nations have migrated, walked from Babylon. In other words, we can see that if it's where the Tower of Babel is, there's the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and we know that those were two of the four rivers. And some people have questioned whether that's where the Garden of Eden was, but it seems that's probably the crescent, the Fertile Crescent would have been the natural place where God would have put things like this. And so it's natural the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, whether that was the exact same river at the time back then, after the flood, we don't know what happened to the earth. But if for that matter, if those were the rivers that were there, then if that's where they're scattering from, then I want you to notice a picture that's here. The Chinese would have migrated, that is, you to walk from one place to another, from the West to China. Now, you got to kind of get your thinking cap on and stay with me just for a second to see how they did this. The Chinese would have migrated or walked from the West to China. Okay, so you get that picture? So here they were, the Tower of Babel is, and then they go this way. Here's where China is here. And so they're going in this direction. Now, if that's the case, look at if they're going in that direction to migrate or to move from one place to another, what kind of word would you have? Well, you have this word migrate, and you kind of see how the pictograph is all there. And then you start putting it all together, and that's how the Chinese create their words. You can look at that word here for walk. You can kind of see the idea of, you know, they're walking. There's the two legs, and they're walking. And then here is, we're going to go into detail here in this word about West, a living breath man. And then you got this word for division. You can kind of see those, each of those points. You can put them in the picture. And again, they kind of put them all together. And you have a great division in the West walking is the word for migrate. But why was migrate, what does that have to do with the West? That's interesting. And this is where they say, well, that's coincidence. Well, they're migrating, they're walking from the West. There's some the great division that took place. We think of the Tower of Babel and then the babbling. And then this great division where they were all together in one place. All the nations were here. And all of a sudden, there's this great division. And they're migrating to the West. Actually, they're looking back. When they're looking for the word West, they're here, they're looking back at here, back west. And let me show you what I mean by that. The Chinese walked from the West, they're over here in what's called the West to them, after a great division. Again, first thing we usually show the Chinese and they go, eh, so what? That's a coincidence. But then you can start throwing on a few others. Then the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Okay, we know that passage. And so you look at the word here, and you can see this word to walk, talk. Here's our word for to create. And you get a word, here's to talk, living dust man. I'll show that again in a minute. Here's that word walking. You can kind of see the movement of it. Here's how they would come up with this word. Talking and walking is the word for to create. But then when you put this word together right here, right there is the same word. You have the word dust. There's that word dust. There's the breathing. That's also the word for a man or mouth of a man. And then here's the diphthong that they would cause right here, which means it brings it to life. So there's a living dust man, and that's the word for talk. But then he walks, and that's the word for create. So the word create has to do with a living dust man who can walk and talk. Was that just coincidence? Well, let's look. How about for the word first? Can you already start to see how some of that's coming together? I bet you some of you can. Some of you are pretty bright. Even Gabe can do that. When you look at living, there's alive, and then you have the dust, and then you have the man. There's living, dust, man. And that's their word for first. So a living dust man was the first man. That's how they would come up with the word for first in this regard. And so that's kind of interesting. According to the Bible, the first man was a living dust man. He was made out of the dust of the earth. According to the Chinese language, they also believed that long, long time ago. Pretty interesting when they came up with their language. Well, let's just do another one here. How about the word for happy or blessed? Somebody who is truly happy. What does it take to be happy? The Chinese kind of come up with a word where they can show that somebody is really, truly happy. So there's your word, but yet, look at that word right there. There's our word Shangdi again, one God. One God, and there's a one right there. There's our man again, or our mouth. And then you got this little character here, which means in a garden. God with a man in a garden is happy. Pretty cool. In the beginning, God and man had close fellowship that led to his happiness. I mean, we think of the Garden of Eden as paradise. It's the happiest a man has ever been on this earth because there was no problems, there was no sin, there was no death. And life was at its best in the Garden of Eden. Well, they thought of that. They thought back to that man, that one man alone in the garden with God, and how happy he would have been. Interesting, isn't it? But then something bad happened in Genesis 3. What happened in Genesis 3? There was the sin. And so when man sinned, there was a separation between God and man. Man's guilt had now separated him from God. So kind of picture the Chinese as they're reading these stories, when we go through some of the stories. Now, what's he going to do with this guilt? When he's feeling this guilt that he's been removed from the garden now, or God's going to punish him, he's got this curse upon him. Now what's he going to do? Well, it's interesting if you think of the word for righteous. What's it going to take for me to be righteous? Well, then God would have the man, and from then on, he would have men make sacrifices. And so to do that, you look at the word hand, and this is a word for knife, basically, or lance. I asked the Chinese, and they would say, well, it's like a knife. That word is more for knife. In their words today, it would have been. So a man holding a knife is the word for me. A man holding a knife is me. Why would they come up with that? Well, because a man holding a knife and killing a sheep makes him righteous. In other words, how is he going to get forgiveness? How is he going to be declared not guilty? It's when God would tell him to offer sacrifices. And you think of the story of Cain and Abel, how God looked at Abel's sacrifice of killing the sheep, and he accepted his sacrifice. And I don't know why he didn't accept Cain's. The Bible doesn't really tell me that, whether he was offering the grain offering. That it might have been what God told him to, but his heart or his motive might have been wrong. We don't really know why God rejected Cain's, except that he didn't do what God said. But in Abel's case, he takes a knife, and how the Chinese might have been thinking is he took a knife and he killed a sheep and he offered it as a sacrifice, and God would declare him righteous. And of course, we know from the Leviticus and other places that's how he did it. Then we go back to the garden just for a few moments here, and we look at this idea of the Chinese and how they're thinking constantly about, when they're creating their language here, they're always thinking back toward the Tower of Babel where their ancestors had just come from. And they think about the word for west. Now, look at this word. It's going to come up again and again in our story. Moses is on the other side. He is on the east side. He's going to give you a verse on this in just a moment, so stay with me. Eden was east for Moses. If you're thinking about Israel and thinking about the Tower of Babel and the Euphrates River, where Syria and Babylon and places like that would be, you had to go west to do that. But Moses is over here in the east, and he's looking this way. But the Chinese are on the other side of that. And so as God planted a garden eastward in Eden, Moses is thinking that way, eastward in Eden. He's already in the west, and he's thinking east. There he put the man whom he had formed. But that's not how the Chinese thought. When they thought for a word for west, they're looking in the other direction. So what are they thinking? A word for west is there's one man in a garden. By the way, that's not a mouth, by the way, because when they put those little areas up there, that changes the word. That's no longer just a mouth. Now it's a garden. It's an enclosure. It's like a box that they put you in. And so one person in a garden is their word for west. So what would make west, if you're in China, you're thinking, what's west? What would be a good word for west? Remember that man in the garden there? Adam in the garden? That might have been obviously what they're thinking. And it seems to me that's the only way that you could have come up with such a word like that when they're creating their language that's so close to the Tower of Babel times, when that's what they would have been, they would have known those stories so well. They would have cut their teeth on those stories. Everything back then was not written language, it was oral language. And they would have been telling these stories over and over again from the garden on, from Adam and Eve on. So this first man needs a woman. We know the story. I'm not going to read it because all you men know you need a woman. And so when it comes down to the story, but Adam had no one like himself. He'd seen these other animals. He was lonely. He said, there's nothing like that for me. And so God says, okay, I've created what I want to create is that loneliness and that need, that desire for someone else. And so the Lord put him into a deep sleep, tapes the rib, makes a woman, presents the woman to him. And then he says, wow, whoa, man. This is now taken out of my man. For this cause will a man go away from his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they will be one flesh. So there you have the story of the man needs a woman. Now, if you're going to come up with a word for that in the Chinese language, how are you going to do it? Well, let's look. Here's that word. There's that word west again. You remember what the word is? One man in a garden is the word for west. Then you got to do something with that. So let's create that word, one man in a garden, throw in the word woman, and you got the word for to desire or to want or is necessary. Now, where else would the Chinese have come up with such a concept as that? A man in a garden and a woman is a great word for desire, to want, to feel necessary, to be a helper. That's a great way to look at that. That's how the Chinese would have no doubt probably come up with what. How else would they have come up with a word like that, writing their language so close to the time of the creation of the world? Anything else just doesn't make much sense. How else would they have done that? God said it is not good that man should be alone. So it's an interesting when you look at that word, beginning or first. This is really interesting. Remember how a while ago when I did that, how many numbers would have that been? One. How many would this be? Yeah, two. Y'all are brilliant. Then you got, again, you got the legs, you got the people. You got two people is the word for beginning. Two people is the word for beginning. Where would they have got that? Isn't that fascinating? They would have got that, obviously. The beginning of time, there was man and woman. God created man and woman, and then the beginning, in Genesis 1, it says he created them male and female. And so the beginning of time, there would have been the beginning or the first for that. But then, of course, then we go to the story in Genesis chapter 3 where the man and the woman are in the garden. There's Adam and Eve, and there's those two trees. And the Lord God put in a garden in the east, in Eden, and he put a man and a woman there, and he said, as he put them in the garden, there's the tree of life, and there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the Kogi tree there. And so you ask the question, when you ask the question, how many special trees are there in the middle of the garden? Obviously, there's many trees in this garden, but there's two special trees that God points out to them. There's the tree of life, and there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so with these two trees, and it's going to be fascinating, and I see this all over China when you can walk around, it's amazing how many words have two trees in them. And you go, what's that about? Well, look at it. Look at the idea that when he put them in the garden and he says there's these two trees, man was forbidden. He was told that you could eat one of these trees, but you're forbidden to eat from this other tree. You eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in that day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So there's a forbidden process that's going there, and there's our word. Now start looking at it. There's our word, forbidden. Can you already see what's going on here? There's two trees. By the way, several years ago, I went to Medtronics. Raylene invited me to Medtronics to give this particular thing, and one of the things they did is they brought a Chinese girl in there because they had promoted the idea that I was going to do this Chinese language, and so they brought this Chinese girl in there, and she watched this whole thing, and afterwards I asked her, well, were those words correct or right? And she said, yeah, dead on. Those are the words. Because I don't know Chinese, but I've done this so many times in China. I've done them, by the way, even in front of college professors. And they don't deny that that's not the word for forbidden. That is the word for forbidden. I didn't make these up. The Chinese have written them. And so here's the two trees. And then you put command. There's the word for command right there. There's a command given in the midst of these two trees, and it's the word for forbidden. So among these two trees, how would you put those two concepts together if you weren't thinking of the Garden of Eden story? When you put that together, the snake's wiser and comes and says that, you know, if you eat, you won't surely die. And he tells that story. And then after he gets through with that whole story, then the woman in the forbidden fruit, it says it's good for food and it's desiring to make one wise. You already know that story. So we're fast forwarding a little bit. And the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together, made for themselves loin coverings. So look at the word where when she says she looked at the fruit and desired it or coveted it and wanted it to be wise like God. Satan had convinced her, if you eat this fruit, you'll be as wise as God. So her desire was for that food and for that that prestige, I suppose, if you want to call it that. She desired or coveted that. But the word coveted, you'll notice that the word, you probably don't know what this one is yet, but you might have seen it just a minute ago. There's those two trees, and there's a woman. Two trees and a woman make up the concept of desiring or coveting. Obviously, to me, it makes sense reading the Bible and seeing that. Why would the Chinese 5,000 years ago come up with this idea, or 4,500 years ago, come up with this idea that to covet or desire, it talks about a woman in the midst of two trees? Well, they knew that story. It was already a biblically well-known story, even though the Bible had not been written for another 1,100 years. Well, then you look at the word for devil. When he's talking to the woman, you can kind of start to see a few things here, how they put their words together. There's that life again, that diphthong for living or motion, life. And there's secret. There's a little secret there. There's a private or secret. There's their word for that. And then you got that garden again. You can kind of see the picture of what a garden would be like. And then you have that man again. So you have a devil, the word devil. They came to come up with the word devil. You had a man in a garden, a living man in a garden, and there's this kind of secret thing going on maybe. Maybe that's what they're thinking. I'm not really sure how they put all that together. But it's just interesting that the devil has to do with a man in a garden, a living man in a garden. Now, you put that combined, and you come up with the word really for temptation or to tempt or to tempt the tempter. What you do is, and you can't really see it so much here as you, if you kind of start looking, you can see a little bit here. The word tempter comes from this word devil. So you got this man in a garden with this motion, and you add to that two trees, and then you also add in a covering. Here's that covering there. And so the word tempter means there's a man in a garden among two trees undercover. Satan is working on him. Satan is trying to get him to see that, you know, God's not looking at you now. You know, let's just you and I talk about this and let's get it. So there's that temptation of a man in the midst of two trees talking to the devil. And so there is the Chinese people. They connected the devil with a garden and two trees. That's kind of the issue here. Then we can just move on. And you think about the word when they saw then that after they'd sinned that they were naked. What are they going to do? That word naked there's two different ways to write it in the Chinese language. And it's interesting if you break them both down. You see Shang Di there? You see the garden? See these things here? What he's saying here is you got a man. There's another man. And then this word fruit here. A man and a fruit is the word for naked. Fruit? Are we talking about fruit of the loom or what? You know, how do they get a man in fruit and come up with a word for naked? What does fruit have to do with it? Well, we know if you read the Bible. Or if you even use the word for clothing with fruit is their word for naked. Fruit and clothing for naked? And yet you go back and think about the story of what happened when Adam and Eve sinned and how they were ashamed and they made for them clothes and then God came and clothed them further and covered their nakedness is maybe what they were thinking when they wrote that language. In Genesis chapter 3, then you had that fruit of going. But then God says in to the woman that if you do this, then I'll multiply your pain in childbirth. Some of you women can testify to this. That you have this pain. Well, again, you see something here. There's the pain, and you have two trees. You eat a piece of the fruit in the midst of those two trees, and it's going to cause pain. Was that coincidence too? What does two trees and a piece, whether it's a piece of fruit, perhaps is the implication there. But it leads to the idea of when pain comes. But then if you look at the idea of what the man had to endure when he ate of the fruit, then he says sorrow would come to him and amongst the thorns and the weeds will come up and the plants of the field will be for your food. So when Adam had to endure his so-called suffering, they came up with this idea that there would be sorrow. But it would be broken down as in the ancient times there would be these weeds would cause sorrow. So the Chinese word for sorrow would be that you would be the thorns and the thistles and the weeds you're going to have to endure in order to eat. Maybe that's what the Chinese were thinking. It seems to be that anyway. We move on to chapter 4 and we can again see the story of Cain and Abel. We won't take time to read all that, but Cain made an attack on his brother Abel and put him to death. You already know the story. So Cain comes along, and the older brother, Cain, kills the younger brother, Abel. So you already know the story, so let's look at it for just a second. I've already kind of told you that just a minute ago about the word shun. Shun is the word for the eldest son. He's a mouth man. And so you put that together. If the Lord said, truly, if Cain is to put to death in seven, in other words, when he's saying, Lord, my sin is greater than I can bear, and he says, if any man comes and touches Cain, I'm going to seven times will be upon him. And so the point is God was going to put a mark on Cain. He was going to put something on Cain to distinguish him from others and say, if you put him to death seven times, punishment will come to you. Well, so you hear of this mouth man, this shun, this eldest son, and notice that you have this eldest son, but there's a mark been put on him. Is that what the Chinese were thinking? What else when you think about a mouth man, the eldest son, with a mark placed on him. And that would be their concept for the word mark. X marks the spot. And that's how we would even say it in our world today. And I've used this in China, and they say, yeah, that makes sense. And so is that what they're talking about here? You got this mouth man, this eldest son, and yet God's going to call him cruel or violent. Cain was cruel and violent. He killed his brother in violence. The first older brother in the Bible was violent, for the words for elder son and violent, in fact, are the same word, shun. Even when you got one with the mark and the one without the mark, they're both the same exact word. So the elder brother is considered the violent one. Then we all know this story of the great world flood. We can look at the story and we can know that Noah, his wife, three sons and their wives, there's eight, right? And so I'm not going to read the whole story, but you already know it. There's eight people on a boat. Okay? So as we read the story then, we look at the idea of eight people on a boat, and as you read the story, I have them count. Noah, you got, you know, Joan of Arc, and then you've got the other three, and then you've got the other three, and you put these eight together, and you can count them, and so I have them count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And so you get down to the eight, and then you say, okay, there's a person, there's eight, there's the number eight in the Chinese language. There's a word for boat, and what does it mean? It means a large ship or a large boat. A large boat with only eight people. And where did they get that? Where did they get the idea of a huge boat, this monstrous place, and there's only eight people on it? And that's their word. Eight people on a boat is the word for a large ship. That's kind of interesting. Well, notice how that pieces together. You got the person, the eight people on a boat is this large ship. But then you have the word eight, the number eight, that's kind of hyphenated here. But this is the word for united. And then you have the word for earth, which means their word, this they would call it horizon for earth. And so you have eight united on the earth is their word for total. Huh? Eight people united on the whole earth is the total population? Yet after the flood, what was the total population of the earth? Eight people, wasn't it? Well, then you take that word, united, eight people on the earth is the total, you add water, and that's their word for flood. There's no mistake about that one. You don't have to even think about whether that's from the Bible or not. That's from the Bible. The Chinese people were thinking those very thoughts when they put their language together, that you had eight people united on the earth combined with water was the idea of a flood. Why would you think of that as a flood? And yet, reading the Bible, you would know that story. And the Chinese people certainly knew that story back then. They didn't even have a Bible and wouldn't have for another millennium. And so that's how you get that. But then when you get said, how they know these stories? They didn't have a writing, so how'd they do this? Again, it was oral transmission. One generation would tell the next generation, and it would be constantly in oral traditions coming down time after time for all these hundreds of years. They would hand them down. And so you have this eight people in water is also their word. So you put all these words together. The total with water is the flood. You have a mouth, eight, and the water. It means to hand down or to continue. In other words, to keep the tradition going. So you have eight people on that water, that flood story, telling it, passing it down from one generation to the next. That's their word for passing it down, continuing the story. And the question would then be, what do we do? And this is where we tell the Chinese people, we must now hand the good news down to the next generation. And so there are literally, there's dozens of more words like this, but for time's sake, you just look at those words and you say, does that make sense? I like to use this even in America to talk about the evidence of the Bible. The evidence of the Bible is just astounding to me. When I can think about, that couldn't have happened by accident. That those stories, when you can go into those places and there's preachers that says those are myths. So first 11 chapters are myth. Larry's been there and they dealt with that. Some of you people, the Johansons and others, were familiar with that story. Where the first 11 chapters, well, we don't know if they were true or not. Yeah, they were true. They were true as they can be. Jesus referenced them. Many people in the New Testament referenced back to the stories in Genesis 1 through 11. Those stories were well documented and they were by oral tradition handed down from generation to generation. And our job is to look and to see, are they true or not? And obviously they are. This is a great evidence that the Bible is true. It dates all the way back to the beginning of the handwriting of the oldest language in the world, the Chinese Mandarin language. goes back and tells these stories again and again and again. The evidence for the Bible is there in the Chinese language. I'll stop there, but I'm doing this to kind of keep refreshing my memory and to get me excited as I go to China. I'll be telling these stories several times while I'm there. I wanted to share those with you, and the reason I want to do this tonight was, instead of just preaching another sermon, I want you to be thinking about this. I'm going to be telling these stories over there, and there's going to be some hearts that can be opened. And I'm asking you to be praying specifically that God will open those hearts there, that we'll be able to reach a few souls that will come to Jesus Christ because of evidences like this. This astounds the Chinese people when they see it because they know their language and they can look at it and they can say, that is amazing. And it opens an avenue to allow them then, maybe there's other things in this book that I need to see. And we begin to read the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and go forth like that, all the way down obviously to the coming of Jesus Christ and how desperately they need Jesus in their life. And so I'm begging you, I'm asking you I'm coveting the word, to be praying that God will open those doors of opportunity for us that we might be able to. In a month from now, I can come back and tell you about some of the souls that have been converted to Jesus Christ. Thank you for your time tonight. I hope this has been a good evidence study for you. It's instilled in you a heart for the truthfulness of the Bible. Those of us who've read it and known it and studied it for years know in our hearts as we think of it, because it's there, that there's plenty of evidence to support that the Bible that you hold in your hand is truly a message inspired from God and has been given to us by God for our hearts to change our lives, to give us purpose in this world. Thank you for your time. And if any of you are convinced by that and want to become a Christian this night, that's what we're here for. Let us help you start your journey of purpose in this world to go and to meet your God. While together we stand and while we sing. After